Hi. How you doing? Good. Great. Good. I see John Murphy's here. He always said that I had a Etch-A-Sketch up here, so I have a new one that looks just like an Etch-A-Sketch, so I have to get it started, so hang on. Hang on. All right. Yes, this is just a fancy piece of notepad paper, so. Okay. Good afternoon to you. It is afternoon. I'm going to give a little bit of a different sermon than usually give with a little help of some visual aids today. I'd like to step through a couple things on prophecy today to give us kind of an update. You know, if you look at how we've covered prophecy in a lot of times in the past, there's a couple ways that we do it well and a couple ways that we don't do it well. When we do it well and we understand prophecy, it's really looking at the trends. It's looking at the general trends and the general direction that they're going. When we kind of stumble or make some mistakes is when we get a little bit too specific. When we start naming names or saying, you know, this person is going to be that beast or this person's going to be that, then, you know, we're usually wrong. So I'd like to take a step back today and look at some of the three major trends that we've covered and that we usually cover when we talk about prophecy in the past. And so I have a human clicker today again, so I don't have my other clicker, so we'll just go ahead and click the slide. And what those three trends are going to be, the first one we'll talk about, or that we usually talk about, is the Middle East and prophecy. Now, specifically today, a trend that I want to talk about is the rise of Islam in the Middle East. A second trend that we talk about when we talk about prophecy is the decline of the West, or, you know, the Western nations, you know, U.S. and Britain and those type of things. And then the third one that we usually talk about is the rise of Europe, or the rise of, you know, the nations in Europe and as they join together creating this united Europe. So, but what we'll find out today is if we start to trace these three trends, that they actually will point to and they interact with each other. These three trends, if you kind of map them out through history, you'll see that they kind of are interwoven and they work together to produce a lot of the events in the end time. So it's not necessarily just taking one of these trends in isolation, but what I like to do is to show how these three trends, if you carry them out, are on a collision course, or that you'll see as these three trends develop how it will fulfill the prophecies that we see in the end time. So this is correct. These are the general trends that we've talked about in the church. And if you look at the understanding of these three trends, they are correct. And they do point and they do, you know, bear truth, or they do show what has happened. So let's just turn quickly to Luke 21 to start this off. And let's start with the Middle East and prophecy. And let's get a little bit of background on this and understand the growth of Islam and what dynamic is taking place, you know, right as we speak right now. So let's turn to Luke 21. And what we see in Luke 21 is we see that Jerusalem is going to be a focus point of conflict at the time of the end. So this scripture, Luke 21, verse 20, it's one that we've all read. We all know it. It says, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near." And if you go down to 22, it says, "For these are the days of vengeance, that all things that are written may be fulfilled." And so what this is saying is that you will see in the end time that Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies and, you know, come to desolation. And at that time is the time of the fulfillment of all of these things. So this key verse is saying that Jerusalem is actually going to be a focal point of a lot of these end-time prophecies. And we know if we look in the Bible that there are so many prophecies that revolve around Jerusalem, the Holy Land, and a lot of things that we see written down there. So we have to kind of look at this area and understand this area, too, to be able to understand how these prophecies are going to take place as well. Now, when we came upon 9/11, I know that, you know, we were all completely shocked and, you know, the world had forever changed, you know, from that point on, that the events that happened there, you know, were just amazingly different than anything that's happened to us in our recent history in America. But we have to take a step back and understand that those events are actually just a continuum of history and things that have been happening throughout history. Sometimes we kind of just take an American-focused point of view, but what I want to show you today is to trace back how that is actually just a continuum of events that have been taking place down through the last 1,400 years. In fact, the the roots of that exact event go way back. And we're going to see some of this from the Bible. We're going to see some of this from kind of the current events or the near history that's taken place. But there's been a classic struggle that's taken place in the Middle East, a historic struggle for, you know, at least 1,400 years between what's known as Christianity and what's known as Islam. And we'll see that the events that took place here recently are just, you know, a continuation of a lot of that. Now let's go back into the Bible. Let's turn back to Genesis 16, because Genesis 16 helps us understand where this started and where the problems originated. So it must be taken in this context because it helps us to understand why there is so much turmoil and why there's probably not going to be any type of resolution to this turmoil either. Let's turn back to Genesis 16. Now, it all starts back with Abraham. The conflicts and things that you see in the Middle East today all start back with Abraham. What happened in the previous chapters is God told him to, you know, flee out of their country and that he will make of them a mighty nation. Now, Abraham heard this. Abraham did depart. But what we see here in this story is we see a story where some tragic events are kind of being unfolded, or the groundwork for some tragic events are being laid right here. Now let's look at Genesis 16 verse 1. And what we see is that Abraham and his wife are going to start to take some of these matters into their own hands is what's happening here. Instead of letting God fulfill and work these things out, they were getting old in age, and they didn't really believe they're going to have a son. So what we see is they kind of took matters in their own hands. So it says in 16 verse 1, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abraham, 'See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain, you know, children by her.' And so Abraham heeded the voice of Sarai. So basically what we have here is they knew that they were promised to have many descendants, but they couldn't quite, you know, see how this was going to work out. So they decided, well, I can't, you know, seem to have any children. So what you should do is just go into my handmaiden and, you know, let's do it that way. So Abraham and Sarah said, okay, this sounds like a decent plan. Let's, you know, make this happen. And so Sarah, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to, you know, husband Abraham to be his wife. And after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, so he went into Hagar, and then she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes." So right away, there's a problem here, right? Going into the handmaiden, well, the handmaiden can have a child, and Sarah can't. So all of a sudden, there is now some tension, you know, kind of a catfight going on here between these two women, because one is now despised in the other's eyes. So you can actually start to see some of the origins of the tension and the hate that goes on here spans all the way back to even to Sarah and Hagar. Some of the tension actually started there. So verse 5 says, "And Sarah said to Abraham, 'You know, my wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes.'" Right, "the Lord judge between you and me." So she said, oops, you know, this maybe was kind of a mistake. Now there's this kind of despising going on. "So Abraham said to Sarah, 'Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do as you please.'" And so what did Sarah do? Sarah dealt harshly with this handmaid. Right, Sarah dealt harshly and she fled from her presence. So she was very kind of harsh with her because she, you know, because of the despising and all that was taking place. And so verse 7 says, "Now, you know, when she fled out, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to shore. And he said, 'You know, Hagar, Sarah's maid, you know, where have you come from and where are you going?' She said, 'Well, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarah.' And the angel of the Lord said to her, 'Well, return to your mistress, submit yourself into her hand.' And the angel of the Lord said to her, 'I will multiply your descendants exceedingly so that they shall not be counted for multitude.'" Now, this is an important concept in a statement here. So there's a prophecy that follows here that describes and helps us to understand something in the origin. Basically, this is the foundation or the origin of the Arab people. The Arab people that we see is founded right here. "So I will multiply your descendants exceedingly." So if we look around the world and look at those who are of Arab descent, and if you see a lot of them, you know why? It's because of God's blessing upon those people. Because of what he declared right here, you do see a multitude of Arab and Arab nations and Arab people there. And God goes on in verse 11 and you know, expounds on this excuse me, even a little bit more, and says, "Behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction." Now, what we see described in verse 12 is also a description of some of the kind of national tendencies of these people. And it says, "He shall be a wild man, His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of his brethren. So this is not just an idle statement, but this is actually the foundation and of the Arab's people. Now, is this something that's kind of hidden from the world? You know, if you talk to Arab people today, it's actually common knowledge, and they will admit and they know that they trace their lineage back through Ishmael all the way back to Abraham. It is a common knowledge that, you know, they will admit and they'll say openly that, yes, they do come from Abraham and they come from the lineage of Ishmael. So this is not something that's kind of hidden from the world, but this is known. So in verse 15 it says, so Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram named his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael, and he was, you know, 86 years old. So he's getting up there in age. And so, you know, what we have, though, even though that he has a son now, we start to get the byproducts of the mess that they're creating, right? We start to get into kind of some of the problems that are created by this. Now, despite the mess that they started, God still blessed through there. And, you know, God blessed Ishmael and his descendants because, as he says later, you know, you are of Abraham's seed. So I will bless your descendants and multiply them. So despite what they started to do, God actually worked it out. You know, he started to work things out, you know, and he blessed the people as they went, but he told Abraham something a little bit, you know, as we drop down a little bit later. So now what happened, though, in the meantime is that they took matters in their own hand, and now they have this son. And, you know, as you can imagine, there's quite a few years here where they have Ishmael until Isaac is actually born. So in that meantime, Abram, as he's called here, you know, starts to work with Ishmael, treat him as a son. It's the son that, you know, he always wanted to have. And so those two, you know, got to be pretty close together. You can imagine, there's so many years, and that's the only son that you actually have. You know, that's his son. So they actually got to be pretty close together. So you can see this played out in the next few scriptures, kind of how it works out. And you can imagine, you know, Abram probably thought, well, I now have a son. You know, there's a little bit of mess here, but I now have a son. And he probably, during that time, even talking with Ishmael, may have, you know, said, you know, God has promised to multiply our descendants, and that's going to happen through you. He could have told him that. He could have told him he's the son of promise. He could have had a lot of discussions with Ishmael during this time. So this starts to play out later. Genesis 17, verse 15, let's turn over to there. You know, how the conflict takes it to the next step. So there's about a period of 13 years where Ishmael was the only son here. Genesis 17, verse 15, it says, then God said to Abram, you know, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations, kings of people shall be from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed in his heart, basically. You know, he said, I'm 100 years old. How am I going to have a child? Right? So, you know, he's like, this just sounds ridiculous. So again, he's still kind of, you know, thinking, I already have a son. I'm 100 years old. How am I going to, you know, have another child? And the next phrase that he utters, verse 18, is pretty revealing. And it says, Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael may live before you. And basically what's wrapped up in there is a lot of emotion, isn't it? Oh, that my son may live before you and be my descendant, is basically what he's saying. And what that is, you know, he's asking God, is saying, look, I have a son here. We have bonded. We're very close. I've been talking with him. You know, oh, that he may be the one that, you know, my descendants go through, is basically what this statement is saying. So he prays that to God, and you can just hear the emotion that's, you know, in the statement. Then God said, no, you know, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his descendants. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. So God didn't ignore his plea, but he said, you know, I have blessed him, and I will make him fruitful, and I will multiply him, you know, exceedingly, and he beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But he says, God said, I had always intended that the blessings and the promises be passed on through Isaac, not Ishmael. So he said, you know, what I have willed and what the path that I have laid down is the way that it's going to come out. So my covenant is going to be established for through Isaac, not Ishmael. Now, this is an important lesson, an important concept to understand because, you know, as God told him later, he said, you know, is there anything that's impossible for me to do? You know, I know you're 100 years old and Sarah too, but there's nothing impossible for God to do. So they kind of stopped and maybe took some matters into their own hands because they couldn't quite see how this was going to exactly work out. So because of that, even though God said, I will bless your descendants, it still laid this groundwork and a framework where this conflict starts to come up. So what happened is, you know, after this, I won't necessarily go through and read all these different things, but when they gave birth to Isaac, you know, there was still, again, this tension between Sarah and the handmaid. And so what happened is Sarah sent her out, sent her gone, sent her and the Ishmael into the wilderness. So you can imagine kind of the turmoil that is happening here, you know, especially with someone like Ishmael who maybe had grown up with Abram and Abraham. And, you know, it said Abraham was displeased kind of at this whole process that was happening. And, you know, a teenage boy who's, you know, maybe 13 or so years old with the father, all of a sudden being completely abandoned and dropped because there's another son that's born that's the son of promise. And guess what? It's not really you. Okay, so you can imagine being sent out into the wilderness. And what we see kind of from this point on is the tension between, you know, Sarah and Hagar, but then we also start to have tension between, you know, Isaac and Ishmael, for one, and then trace that down through the descendants of those two, and you start to see, you know, if you take it even further, you look at some of the next generation that happened, it doesn't stop there. We get down to, you know, Isaac, and then we get to Jacob and Esau. You know, what started to happen with Jacob and Esau is there, again, is this rivalry, right? Rivalry going on, and Jacob kind of tricked Esau out of the birthright, and then Esau got really mad, you know, because God intended that the birthright would pass down through Isaac and then through Jacob, and not through Esau. So a lot of that was God's hands, but it doesn't do away with the fact that the person who was seen as the loser, the one that actually despised that birthright, didn't really care, saw it as something being taken away from them, right? And this theme right here that you hear, this is our birthright, this is what was promised to us, but somebody took it away from us, that concept has not stopped down through the years, all the way up until today. It started right here. Right, and if you look at Islam and the religion of Islam, it's very interesting because they, you know, there, a lot of the Arab people who are Muslims know that they're descended from Ishmael, and so what the Quran says is it says something different. It has a kind of a different twist on the stories that you see in the Bible. In fact, the Quran says that it was really Ishmael was the one that Abraham was offering up as a sacrifice. It wasn't Isaac. So they've actually changed that story and say that it was supposed to be Ishmael. Ishmael was the son of promise and the one that was to be offered up, and that was where all of the blessings were supposed to go through. So they've woven the story that way. And they say, well, the Bible is actually fabricated by the Jews to be the other story. And so what you have here is you have one group firmly believing it was Ishmael and they're entitled to the promises. The other is the Bible, and it shows that Isaac and all the promises were to happen down through them. How do you rectify that? Well, you don't, do you? Right? And you can see that from the start in the beginning of this kind of mess that happened here, the groundwork is laid for there forever to be this, never to be reconciled, these misunderstandings and these quibblings of who should own and who should inherit this land. Okay, so the framework and the groundwork is laid here. So, and we see this, you know, carried on down through the ages. You know, a lot of things happened. Jacob fled from his family, you know, and was estranged for a number of years. And the descendants of Jacob became known as the Israelites. You know, Esau became the father of people that the Bible calls the Edomites, right? And so the relationship between these two people, at times has been peaceful, and other times it's bordered on genocide, completely wiping the other out. So the origins of the conflicts that you see today are not idly something that just came about today, but trace all the way back to this event, and then over the years you can see how it has played out on the world scene. So Let's move this over and look at another trend that's happening here. So you start to see, first of all, tension in the Middle East. Now, there's another dynamic and another very interesting trend that's taking place right now that we can see will bear out on the world scene. So let's take a look at a map here. And what I'd like to do is go through a series of maps. This may be a little bit hard to see. Can you see it at all? A little bit? Okay. I'll kind of describe what it is, but if you can see what this is a map. There's a map. This is Africa, you know, Europe. You've got Russia and everything. I'm using the modern-day terms. But this is a map, and this is a picture of what I have drawn or circled around in the red. So there's kind of this red amoeba-looking thing. That's actually not a a stain on the slides, but there's this red thing, and what that red line represents is it represents the Muslim expansion until 661 AD. So this map is actually 661 AD in time, and that's basically the time where Islam was created, or the Islam religion was created. Now, what happened during the 600s is basically all of the Arab peoples in this region were just divided into a number of different tribes, right? They were just random tribes all over the place. They were steeped in all kinds of different practices, pagan practices and things. And in that year, during the month of Ramadan, 661, this is supposedly when Muhammad, the prophet, received his visions, right? It's to say what were known as his divine revelations. And then they were eventually codified or into a Muslim holy book called the Quran. So during that year is this time when Muhammad came on the scene. And what Muhammad did, which was very interesting, is he took all of these random tribes of all these Arab peoples in this region, and under this religion of Islam, started to unite all these people. So we had just kind of, random tribes. What you start to see is unification, and that unification or the influence of the Muslim religion was at 661 kind of contained in that red space right there. Now, let's take a look at a second map, and what we'll see is we'll go through our progressions of maps, and we'll see that by the time we get to 750 AD, that this religion has started to spread its influence to a number of different locations. You can see that now it started to dip down to the top of Africa and all the way up, starting to go into Europe, what is Spain over there, and also up into Baltic regions, or the bottom of Russia there. You can start to see that this is, 150 years or so. The spread of this ideology and what he started is now starting to just move all over the place. Now, you have to remember, all of these maps are before there was anything like, radio or, airplanes or TV or anything. This is, basically on horseback or foot or whatever. The ideology of this religion is just starting to sweep through this. Now, let's take a look at the next map. We go forward another 150 years, and we start to see again, that it's spreading even further down the coast of Africa, even further up, and encroaching a little bit up into Europe. So the spread of Islam by 900 is even a little bit further. Let's take a look at map number 4, and we'll see that this is really starting to get entrenched. Like, it's way down into Africa. Like, this territory of the religion is now moving and encroaching way down into the middle of Africa, even down the coast of Africa. Look how far down that has gone, right? And then kind of skirts around Madagascar. Back up over here, you can see now it's gone east over into the top of India. So what we know as India today, right? We see that the religion's there, up through India. Now it's starting to move up into the mainland. And you'll also see it's still kind of in the bottom of Spain, but not as much. But now we have Turkey. Turkey on the right of the Mediterranean Sea there, on the east side of the Mediterranean Sea, is now, being influenced there. So let's, about this time, this is the 1100s or so, and what happened is, during this time, we have something that are called the Crusades, right? And the Crusades happened because in Europe, there was a war over the Holy Land. So what's happening here is the Holy Land there in Jerusalem is taken over and ruled by these different governments that are set up here that are basically Muslim religion, mainly Arab peoples at the time. But then the Crusade started, where Europe says that we need to reclaim back some of the Holy Land. So for about 200 to 300 years in this time period from 1100 on, we start to see Europe starting the Crusades, which is to go down and let's recapture in war and bring back this Holy Land. So we have the start of a conflict between what's known as Christianity. When I say Christianity, I'm generally talking about, Roman Catholicism, right, and the general Christianity concept. So Islam warring against the general Roman Catholic Catholicism. Let's go forward to 1300 on the next slide. And you can see, again, further down in Africa, around Madagascar, now we're, three-quarters of India, minus the bottom part of India there, starting to creep even further east. We're creeping over even a little bit into what we know as China now today, going up a little bit further Europe. Turkey's still there. Looks like Spain has been pretty much recaptured back by the Christian religions. And then let's go up to the next slide, which is 6, which is by 1500s. So by 1500 AD, you can see this religion of Islam is now way into Africa. That's, you know, at least half to almost three quarters if you look at the landmass, all the way down here through the Indonesian area, most of India, starting to creep into what we know as China, and now making its way up even further or encroaching into Europe at the top. You see the pointy part up there. It's made a lot of progress up into this place. And basically what that means is the religion is gone, and most of the people in that area, the predominant people in the area, believe now in the Islam religion, or are Muslims at this point in time. So over this period of a few hundred years, what we see here is predominantly in Europe, there's Christians. And this Muslim religion is now just taking over this entire Mideast area and starting to push up against Europe and Christianity there. Right? So in history, this struggle goes back 1,400 years. This is not new. This is not a new thing. This has been going on for in history for at least 1,400 years. So let's take a look. I have another set of maps that show this a little bit. It's some of the same things, but let's look at the next map. Now, what this map shows is the same concept. I don't have the entire big of an area, but this is basically the Mideast area in Europe. And what you see are two different colors, and it may be hard to kind of decipher the colors, but what is in green is basically those who are the Islam religion, or the areas that are under the influence or are just Islamic areas or countries there. What is red is those that are controlled by Christianity, Roman Catholicism, and you know the different variants of that. And so you'll also see a dark shading. There's a kind of a dark shading and a light. It may be hard to see, you know, with the lights to where they are. But dark means that during this century, and this first century is the 8th century, this first map, I'm sorry, is the 8th century, or 700s, right? The dark area was firmly already Islam. The area that's light green is the area during this century that was captured or taken over by, you know, Islam. The red area where it's dark is Christianity. Where it's kind of like light red shade is the area that Christianity won during this time period. So we're looking at it kind of in big slices of 100 years or so, and it's saying during that time, Islam took over, you know, the light green shaded areas, and Christianity took over the other areas. Now, you'll see some that kind of are crossed, or bars that are crossed. That's where there may have been a Christian area, for example, red, and the green took that over, or Islam. So let's look at the next slide, and we'll see in the 9th century, here on slide 8, Islam is spread to a number of different locations. It's actually taken over, for example, look up there in Spain and a number of different areas. You can start to see where there are crosses. Some of the green is, you know, crossing over and taking over some of... there we go. Okay. You can kind of see where it's encroaching on it. Let's go to the next slide, which is the 10th century, or 900s. And you'll see down here at the bottom where there was red Christianity, you see green starting to overlap and to dominate that and start to take that over down the coast, you know, of Africa, what we see here. And then what you see as Turkey... it's still Christian controlled there, right? But right to the east of it, that used to be Christian controlled, but now it's been taken over. And Islam religion is now taken over that whole area and the people's there. And you'll see up at the top in Europe, Christianity is kind of starting to march a little bit east. But we still have Spain as a problem. And let's go to map 10 then, which is finally, let's look at the 11th century. And this is basically when the Crusades started. You'll see Turkey at this point in time now is completely taken over. Right, we're encroaching up there. We see Spain, a little bit of Spain is recaptured, and we see more starting to march down through Africa. At about this time is when the Crusades started again. But the point of these maps is really to show that there has been a historic battle here, or a historic confrontation struggle between Christianity and Islam that goes back many, many thousands of years. And you can see that. What is that area up there that's red? This is basically Europe. Now, that's going to come into play as we look at the last trend a little bit later. Like I said, these trends are not just idly separated, but they're actually interwoven. Okay, so let me just continue on here. So there's been this clash. Now, what happened at the end of all of this is that whole area, in fact, the whole area around this region by 1600 on one of my previous maps was what was known as the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire had this whole kind of Mideast area during this time. Now that we come up to World War I, near recent history, And we have the Ottoman Empire. The only problem the Ottoman Empire made, or they made a big mistake, because they aligned with Germany during World War I. So what happened is, since they aligned with Germany, Germany lost. Their whole Ottoman Empire, or this whole region in this area that was just kind of this big empire, you know, collapsed at the time. So it didn't continue on. Now, after World War I, then, there's some very interesting things that happened. Since this whole empire ruled this whole region, you'll notice there's not necessarily, these things aren't broken up as states. This was one big kind of mass of, you know, loosely affiliated things that were all under the same basic rule, the Ottoman Empire. After World War I, though, when they lost, there was something called the Treaty of Versailles, which basically came in and divided or carved up this land into different nation states. So after World War I, the loss and the empire collapsed, they said, look, we're going to carve this up. Now, this treaty, World War I was called the War to End All Wars. This treaty was called the Peace to End All Peace. Because as they were making this treaty, they realized by carving it up into these different states that there's going to be a lot of problems here, right? So this thing now all of a sudden divided it up into different geopolitical states after World War I. And what we have in that area is nothing but conflict, right? This is just kind of near recent history. And one of the last remaining problems that happened here is down in Jerusalem, Britain ruled that whole area of Palestine. And about 30 years after that, a lot of the Jews, you know, in that 30-year time frame after World War I, moved into the area. By the time you get to 1948, the British couldn't control this anymore. So what Britain did is they pulled out, and they went to the United Nations and said, you know, help us resolve these problems. So what happened is the United Nations said, okay, let's create a nation state there. And they created the nation state of Israel right in the middle of all this, which, again, was occupied by who? Right? Basically, the brother that was on conflict to the all the people around us. So what happened was this nation state was created. The Jews then occupied this. And then guess who thinks that they should have that land or should own that land or has a right to that land? And guess who the problem is? Who gave them that land? Who gave them that, you know, that land there? Was the British Empire, which we were cohorts with, basically said, here, you can have it. So when you look back through the history of how long they've occupied that area, how long they've had it, from the beginning they thought that they should always own it, and then not until very recently, after World War I, was it carved up, and then this little section given to the Jews. Of course, they don't see it as just a recent historical thing. They see it as a continuum of the past 1,400 years or more in land that they were promised a right to, should own, and have occupied. So this conflict is actually larger than it sounds. It's not just kind of a, you know, a small type of a conflict. But what we see, though, out of this is there a lot of the Bible prophecies couldn't have been fulfilled until this actual nation state was created, could it? So until no near recent time in history, a lot of these prophecies were never going to be fulfilled. Until that nation state history, nation state was put right in the middle of that of Israel, a lot of things couldn't have happened the way that they were. Now, again, this becomes a center of conflict. Now, the Christianity also sees that as a holy land, right? The Muslims claimed that area. The Jewish people claim that area as well. So we kind of have this three-way conflict over that one little section. So as I said in the beginning, this area is going to be a focal point of end-time events because look at how these things are trending and look at where they've come from. So I'll leave the slides for just a little bit. So if you want to bring the lights back up, you can. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, if we kind of look at this, in fact, let me just look at one more slide. We'll click to the next slide. I'll just leave this on the screen to look at. And what this basically shows is Muslim distribution today. These countries that are dark green are those that are fundamentally Muslim. And you'll see how much of Africa, all of Turkey, and now it's going up into the Balkan states. You know, the theater capture that we heard before, Chechnya, you know, that was because of the Muslims there as well. So this whole area you can see how far this is thoroughly entrenched in this area. What this also shows to us is that we now have a different threat or an enemy. You know, before the threat was always communism, wasn't it? And before that was fascism or something else. But I think what we see because of this trend and where it's going, that Islam now is becoming or is a big problem on the world scene. Now, I'm not saying every, you know, Muslim is going to, you know, take up arms or anything like that, but, you know, it's generally the militant Islam, and we don't necessarily know where a lot of these countries in this area stand, but I think you can kind of guess, depending, you know, seeing how their actions are, the tinderbox and all that's waiting to happen here in this area. Now, how many people recently in the news read or saw something, Osama bin Laden's letter to America? How many people read or saw that? I'm very surprised how much that people have not seen it and how much our media ignored that. Now, you know, it's apparently a letter written by Osama bin Laden. It was translated and posted on websites, but it was a letter to America asking and answering the questions, why are we attacking you and what do we want you to do? And it's amazing to me, it's very surreal, this whole thing, that how much the media just completely ignored that whole letter and what's going on. It's almost like we don't even care about what's happening here. Now, whether it was written by him or not, I don't think is really relevant, because what it does show is it does show the Islamic fundamentalist mindset, right? Whether it's written from him or not, this is exactly how a lot of these countries view us. So let me actually, I'm going to read a few excerpts from this letter for you, because it's very revealing, the content in there. So some American writers have published articles under the title, On What Basis Are We Fighting? Right? Here's an explanation of them. Question one, why are we fighting and opposing you? And then two, what are we calling you to do and what do we want from you? As for the first question, why are we fighting and opposing you? The answer is very simple. Number one, because you attacked us and continue to attack us. Part of that is you attacked us in Palestine. Right? And it says here, it quotes, the British handed over Palestine with your help and your support to the Jews who have occupied it for more than 50 years. He's calling out the Treaty of Versailles and handing over that land is what he's saying. This is our land and you helped them occupy it is what he's saying. That's one of the points. And then he also says it brings us both laughter and tears to see that you have not yet tired of repeating the fabricated lies that the Jews have a historical right to Palestine and was promised to them in the Torah. Anyone who disputes with them on this alleged fact is accused of anti-Semitism. This is one of the most fallacious, widely circulated fabrications in history. The people of Palestine are pure Arabs and original Semites. It is the Muslims who are the inheritors of Moses, peace be upon him, and the inheritors of the real Torah that has not been changed. Muslims believe in all of the prophets, including Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. Peace and blessings and Allah be upon them. If the followers of Moses have been promised a right to Palestine in the Torah, then Muslims are the most worthy nation of this. So he's not necessarily, he's just saying that, you know, they're the most worthy nation of all the promises that are promised there because of who they believe in and who they follow, that they should receive those blessings. When the Muslims conquered Palestine and drove out the Romans, Palestine and Jerusalem returned to Islam, the religion of all the prophets, and peace be upon them. Therefore, the call to a historical right to Palestine cannot be raised against the Islamic that believes in the prophets of Allah. And then another point, it says, the blood of pouring out of Palestine must be equally revenged. And then it says, other points, you've attacked us in Somalia. It says, you steal our wealth and oil at paltry prices because of the international influence and military threats. This theft, indeed, is the biggest theft ever witnessed by mankind in the history of the world. Your forces occupy our countries. You spread your military bases throughout them. You corrupt our lands and you besiege our sanctities. You have starved the Muslims of Iraq, is a point he brings out, where children die every day. Is it a wonder that more than 1.5 million Iraqi children have died as a result of your sanctions and you did not show concern? Yet when 3,000 of your people die, the entire world rises and has not yet sat down. Right? So the war on Iraq is another thing that's an issue in this whole thing. You have supported the Jews in their idea that Jerusalem is their eternal capital and agreed to move your embassy there. The tragedies and calamities are only a few examples of your oppression and aggression against us, right? And it says it's commanded by our religion, basically, to we have a right to fight back. And then it says, well, you may dispute that all the above does not justify aggression against civilians for crimes that they did not commit and offenses which they did not partake. So this argument contradicts your continuous repetition that America is the land of freedom and its leaders in this world. Therefore, the American people are the ones who choose their government by way of their own free will, a choice which stems from their agreement to its policies. Thus, the American people have chosen, consented to, and affirmed their support for the Israeli oppression of the Palestinians, the occupation and usurpation of their land, and its continuous killing, torture, punishment, and expulsion of the Palestinians. So the American people are the ones who pay taxes, which fund the planes that bomb Afghanistan, the tanks that strike and destroy our homes, etc. He's saying the American people are not exempt in this. We're the ones who actually pay the taxes and elect the leaders that are doing all these type of things. American military is American people. And he goes on to say a lot of different things, right? Allah has said that we can take revenge. And then he says, let's answer the second question. What do we want you to do? What are we calling you to do? The first thing is that we're calling you to Islam. So I doubt that's going to happen, right, to this country. Pretty big demand, but as they have done through all these countries, they want to do to our country as well. He says a few other things in here, dropping down. It's this religion that we call you. It says they say the Quran is the book, will remain unchanged while other messages have been changed, referring to the Bible. The second thing that we call you to do is stop your oppression, lies, and immorality and debauchery that are spread among you. We call you to be a people of manners, principles, honor, and purity, to reject the immoral acts of fornication, homosexuality, intoxicants, gambling, and trading with interest. You are a nation, you know, rather than ruling by Allah and the Constitution and laws, choose to invent your own laws as you desire. It says you're a nation that permits usury, which has been forbidden by all religions. You're a nation that permits the production, trading, and usage of intoxicants. You permit drugs. You only forbid the trade of them, even though your nation is the largest consumer of them. You're a nation that permits acts of immorality, and you consider them to be pillars of personal freedom. Who can forget your President Clinton's immoral acts committed in the Oval Office? He calls that out, and how that you did not bring him to account. Right? He sees that as a sin against us. You're a nation that permits gambling in all of its forms. You're a nation that exploits women like consumer products. You're a nation that practices trade in sex. And because all this you have been described in history as a nation that spreads diseases that were unknown to man, he gives us credit for spreading AIDS, right? So some of these statements obviously are not true. So, you know, you've destroyed a lot of things, right? You've in acts of immorality. He goes on to describe other things, right? But he says, you know, one of your major characteristics is your duality in both manners and values. You're hypocrites is what he's basically saying. Your policy on preventing and forcibly removing weapons of mass destruction to ensure world peace, he explains that one. And he explains a few other things. So he says that, you know, we want you to take an honest stance with yourself. He says, I doubt you will do so, to discover that you're a nation without principles or manners and without values and, you know, et cetera. So he goes on to name quite a few other things, but I just thought that was a very revealing letter. And, you know, you can, if you go on the internet, you can find that. Go to Google and search for, you know, Osama bin Laden's letter to America, and it'll come up. You can read the whole text of that. But it's very revealing. Even if it wasn't from him, that helps us understand that the religion of most of these nations and how they view America at this time. So I don't know about your reaction to that, but I had a couple initial reactions. You know, one of my first reactions was that he's doing a good job of convicting America of the sins, was my initial reaction, and that, you know, maybe we should be thinking about, you know, and asking God what he wants us to do and what he wants us to say to the states. That was my initial reaction. I thought, oh, this guy's doing a job of getting a message out in some ways, right? The second reaction was, you know, there are a lot of these statements aren't true in here, and they're kind of, again, they sound like statements of deception and a deceived mind, too, you know, explaining some of the origins of some of these things. So, you know, he's clearly someone who is deceived and deceiving others, which, you know, is a hallmark of Satan's methods of how he works and how he works on things, right? So there's some truths in there, but there's a lot of things that are not quite true. All right, so let's go through the last couple trends. We'll do these kind of in rapid succession. So that's one trend. There's this rise of Islam, and you can see it spread all over the place. Now, the second trend is the decline of the West, right? And the decline of the West is happening at an equally fast pace as well. Let's look at the next map here. And what we see is, you know, it's a map we're all familiar with. This is the American America and the British Empire at the height of its power. So anything you see that's orange is basically the British Empire there. And they ruled at the height of the power, all of these areas and territories, you know, down in India, Australia, down through Africa. And America at that time, as Britain was pretty much dominating the world, was pretty much building its infrastructure or moving west, you know, starting to create the land. So during this period of history, Britain was this huge empire. In fact, it was full of like a quarter of the world's people belonged to the British Empire. Huge history. In a time of great peace and a time of great domination. And we see this, I won't have time to read it, but in Genesis 48, when Joseph's sons were blessed, Ephraim and Manasseh, it says you will be a great nation and a company of nations. And that is carried forth, and that is the fulfillment of that, is you see a company of nations, right, the British Empire, and then a great nation, the single greatest nation, which would be America at this time. And so they, you know, after World War II, though, a lot of this changed, and the things that changed in this map was that Britain started to pull out of these different areas, right? It pulled out of India, and so then what happened? You know, on the surface, it sounds like, oh, that's a good thing. And political correctness tells us to say that, you know, it's good that these nations have now become independent and on their own. But what has happened in those areas? Look in Africa. You know, it's most of these nations, once they're pulled out, when the British Empire ruled them, they all had their own parliament, people had a vote in there, and there was a certain amount of structure that happened in these nations. So it was actually a good thing. When they pulled out, there was a big void that was left. And what you see is most of these nations are in conflict or at war. You know, most of Africa, look at what's replaced it. All these dictatorships, all this suffering, all these people, right, that is what has replaced it. So because of the vacuum when the British Empire pulled out of all these areas, it left a lot of things. You know, political correctness doesn't like to, you know, admit that, but that was actually a good thing that the British Empire was in a lot of these areas. But after World War II, a lot of these things went down. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 28, and I will read this scripture because this helps us to understand a lot of these events. Deuteronomy 28 is actually one of the most important chapters to understand the events that are happening to the United States, the events that are happening to our country, and why that they're happening. Deuteronomy 28, verse 1, we know this is the blessings and cursing chapter. How does this apply? It says, it came to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all of his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord will set you high above all nations of the earth. In verse 2, it says, all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because if you obey the voice of the Lord. Right? So if these nations obeyed God, they would be blessed. Now, just consider for a moment. We know that the U.S. and Britain didn't keep all of God's commandments, but think back during the Victorian times, and we'll see, or in the 1800s, you know, most of our laws and what decisions we did were based on the Ten Commandments, right? The one that would be kind of not correct was there wasn't an understanding of the Sabbath in there, right? But loosely, there was a big emphasis on the Ten Commandments, basing things on God's law. So in a general sense, you know, Britain and America set their hearts to obey God and his laws, you know, in a general sense. And you see that there was this huge blessings, you know, from that. Now, that changed. I mean, look at us today. You know, look at the Pledge of Allegiance in school because it has the word God in it. Can you believe how far the opposite that we've come? And there is not an emphasis in basing a lot of our laws and decisions and things on God's law. It's not politically correct to have God around. And somebody who's an atheist can have, you know, this huge equal view of things, right? We have gone the opposite way. So let's go to verse 15 in Deuteronomy 28. It says, it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments and statutes which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Curse you shall be in the city, curse you shall be in the country, curse shall be your basket and your kneading bowl, curse shall be the fruit of your body. In verse 4 it says, blessed shall be the fruit of your body. That's an interesting one, because back in the heyday of things, it wasn't uncommon for people in Britain and the United States to have, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 kids, right? The fruit of their body was very fruitful. You know, some may have died and things like that, but, you know, be honest, do you think you consider it a blessing to have a lot of kids today? You know, or we're in such of a structure in a society that it's actually, you know, seen as a curse. We limit our families way down, you know, and that's what we try to achieve because we can't make ends meet. We both have to work, you know, all these type of things. Plus, with abortion, we're actually killing our children. So if you start to look at the trend of kind of where it was, there was, you know, this time where there was just fruitful multiplying. And people of Britain and America were just going all over the place. But what's happened is, since World War II, we're in retreat. We're going the opposite way. Our population is on the decline. There is a certain number of people that you have to have born to keep a kind of a consistent population, right? I think it's 2.1, you know, per family. But we have less than that. We have like 1.5 children. So what that means is that this population boom, we're actually shrinking. Our country's on a retreat when you look at the fruit of our womb. These countries over here, if we go to the next slide, here, they're on the opposite track. They have a huge population boom. It's only a matter of mathematics and time to look at a period in time where there will be a complete outnumbering of people who are Islamic and then those who are America and the British countries because of the trend and the path that we're actually on. So today it's actually seen as a curse, right? And the birth rate's extremely high. You know, a 20-year period, 25-year period, the number of peoples that, you know, descended from the tribe of Joseph will go down by about a quarter, where the number of people here will go up by, you know, a couple 100%. There's other curses that you see, birth defects and things like that, right? It's epidemic. You know, autism now is, you know, estimated to be 1 in 300 births now. And in California, it's 1 in 200 births. So when it says, you know, curse shall be the fruit of your body, there's a lot of ways that you're starting to practically see these trends. There's crop problems today. Foot and mouth disease hasn't quite hit us, but look how much beef was destroyed over, you know, in Europe because of this. That is, these prophecies in Deuteronomy help us to understand and see the reasons why. And if you read down, you know, in verses there, you know, read that today or sometime and start to think about how this applies to us today in the trends that we are. Right, so the last trend, which I'll cover, and I'll take about 5 or so more minutes if that's okay with you. The last trend that I'll cover is the rise of Europe. Let me cover this quickly. Let's turn to Daniel 11:40, and we'll read one scripture here because it's very telling. So what we have is Islam trending up, the West trending down, and if you think about that, we're going to have a problem after a while, aren't we? Right, these are general trends that are happening, and those two are on a collision course to be problematic. Now, the rise of Europe is an interesting one that we've always talked about. Daniel 11, verse 40 is a prophecy that we talk about. It's the king of the south and the king of the north. Right? It says, I'm going to just drop down to verse 40 and cover the prophecy portion that refers to the time of the end. It says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. He's going to attack the king of the north. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. In verse 41, guess what's at the center of this? Again, he shall enter the glorious land. Right? Again, another prophecy. Now, the King James Version phrases this very interesting. It says that the king of the south shall push at him. Right? Push at the king of the north. And if you look at that word, it's got different meanings. It doesn't necessarily, you know, deliberately mean a big attack, but what's happening here? Right? What is the trend that's happening here? Like I said before, we generally understand from the prophecies before that the king of the south will be, you know, loose confederation or the nations that are in the Middle East here, and they'll be united under somebody. We don't know who that is, but a lot of the focus that's going on today is how do we unite all these nations, and they want to unite it around Iraq. They were going to unite it around a lot of these different activities that you see going on. But the king of the south would represent, again, it's south of Jerusalem, nation south of Jerusalem. King of the north is north of Jerusalem, right? Think of it kind of, you know, geographically, that's what it means, that there's going to be unity at some point in time here under somebody, and they'll push against the king of the north. But you can already see them pushing against. Look at how much the Islamic religion has crept up into this area, and it's pushing against Europe. What do you hear Europeans saying today? What are the cries of some of the leaders? Right? It's very interesting that a lot of them are talking about limiting immigration, closing their borders, right? Not allowing a certain amount of people. And why is that? You'll hear all kinds of reasons, but when it gets down to it and you get down to the real reasons, it's because of the problem of Islam. You see Turkey there, right next to the Mediterranean? That was a big integral part of Europe in the past for many, many years. Turkey is not allowed into the EU. Why not? Look at the color of the state right now. That's the main reason, is the problem of Islam. One of the leaders said it's because of Islam. They're afraid that this will spread throughout and take over their country. So again, this is not just today. This is 1,400 years of history saying, look, this has been a historical struggle, and it's happening again. So what you're going to see are some interesting things. All of these things are on a collision course, aren't they? Right? I have an article here that was written by a Muslim saying, what's the solution to this? They're saying, Europe should open its borders to us. Why? Because you need more population. We can be cheap labor, and you can come down to Africa because we got the best beaches. That can be like your Florida. This is what this article says. It says, you know, let open your doors. If you keep your doors closed, you're an empire that's not going to last. And they're saying, we'll be cheap labor. Let us in. Don't worry about it. You can come down and retire in our, you know, beaches, is what they're saying. It's very interesting. That's the view that's happening now. Guess what? All these trends, the decline of the West, us, Britain, the rise of Europe, Islam threat here, pushing against Europe, I think you can see that we're poised to start to fulfill or start to see some of these things together. Wouldn't that be an incredible reason for them to want to unite Europe, you know, to against a common threat? Same with religions. Catholic Church is making a call. In fact, this week is a week of prayer that the Pope has designated, saying all the religions should pray for unity, that we can all come together. Who is he talking about? He's talking about the Catholic Church and all the offshoots, the Protestants and things like that. Because their religions are closer together than they are versus Islam. So I think you can see, again, covering these three main trends or these three areas, that Islam is on the rise, America and Britain are on the decline, and then it's being pushed against the same struggle for many, many years against Europe. You know, and if you put those things together and see how it plays out, I think we can really start to see that, you know, without making specific dates or things, a lot of the reason why you may start to get unity in Europe, unity of religions, you know, like a Catholic Church and things like that, and how that'll play out. So with that, let me stop because I'm about 5 minutes over. Hope that's been interesting, but, you know, just wanted to cover some of the basic trends to help us to understand and put that in our thinking. And when you read the news, like, think about those three trends, right? Because you'll see them. There's not a problem today that doesn't involve something around all three of these.